Welcome back, Hemingway listeners, to the Hemingway List podcast. It's 4 in the morning. And today's episode is brought to you by the beverage, decaf coffee. Decaf because it would be crazy to drink a real coffee at 4 in the morning, especially when you just had one, a real coffee, at 3:30 in the morning, not half an hour ago. 3:30 a.m. coffee. Wow, you're up early. You could say that. I don't know if what I'm up. I don't know if I'm up early. I don't late. I don't know if this is an extension of yesterday or the beginning of tomorrow. This is what I did. At about 7:30 p.m., I felt my eyes grow a little heavy. Thought, I'll just have a little nap. Then I woke up and it was 12:30 in the morning, just past midnight. So how long is that? 7:30, 8, 30, 9, 10, 11, 12. 5 hours of sleep I had. So that's a sleep. That's not a nap anymore at that point, is it? Nah. Okay, so what is it then? This quarantine thing, I tell you what. I'm bad at it. I can't even figure out what day it is. Not only that, it's like, I can't even figure out, like, if my sleep cycle had just shifted, I would know, like, oh, well, okay, seeing as I got up at this time, it's approximately lunchtime now, even though it's this hour of the morning. So, lunchtime food, that's what's appropriate. But I just, like, I'm just sleeping in little increments and then getting up, another increment, then maybe a big increment, then a small increment, then a coffee, then another increment, then another coffee, then two coffees, then a decaf, then an increment. It's just a muddled up, mixed up world. Day 11 of isolation? Day 10? Day 10? I don't know. Like I said, I don't know what day it is anymore. 10 or 11 days of isolation. Guess you could say I've sort of lost my routine somewhat. There's people who are doing this isolation thing and they're just like, what do you mean stay up late? I've got work tomorrow. It's like you're working from home. Yeah, I know, but I still have to get up and I just do a normal day just from home. I don't get that. That ain't me. That ain't me. Today we are here to speak to you, to speak together about chapter 12 of The American. BYO discussion prompts. I don't know why, nothing popped into my head for a discussion prompt, so blank slate. Seems to have worked quite well. We had 8 comments made. Swim said, the Mama Fishy said, this is possibly the most cold-blooded romance love story I've ever read. Yeah, true. And also, like, I don't know, I'm starting to just feel like that's the plot of the book, you know? Just a romance. And it's a little disappointing. Like, I really love the setting. I really love the characters. And I kind of like what they're up to. Like, I like how the American's just there to explore, you know, and he's got this money and I don't know, it's just it's a cool premise for a book. And then it's like, within that premise, are they just going to make it a matchmaking love story? Or, you know, because that's not enough for me, I think. Maybe I'm not very romantic or something, but if a book is just a romance, like Anna Karenina, it bores me to tears, to be honest. Not literal tears, but metaphorical ones. Like Anna Karenina, would you call it a romance? I suppose you would. But it was solely concerned with romance, is what I mean. It wasn't necessarily romantic, but everything in the book, every challenge of every character was to do with their romantic relationship. And I just don't care, because it's just the most normal thing, you know? Like, I'd love to read a book about someone doing something out of the ordinary, and be like finding a partner is just, it's exciting. Don't get me wrong. I'm a sucker for romance and I'm a bit of a matchmaker, but it's not abnormal. It's not special. Everyone does it. Might as well write a book about someone deciding what to have for lunch. And then at the end, I'm meant to be like, oh, they decided on a sandwich. What a special and unique person. No, no. You just did what everyone else does. Don't write a book about it. No one gives a shit. And that's what this book seems to be being. And that's a bit disappointing. I am enjoying it a lot. I'm enjoying this a lot more than I enjoyed Anna Karenina. I'll give you that. Swim said the mama fishy said, Grade Saver gave me an explanation. Newman is a very driven and ambitious character, but he has, by a relatively young age, achieved all his financial and career goals. Because he has focused more on obtaining money than enjoying it, he doesn't actually know how to spend it in any way that will make him happy. And it turns out to not be very interested in many of the things, art, architecture, and design, that someone might typically spend their wealth on. This sense of purposelessness helps to reveal why Newman becomes so fixated on marrying Claire. She becomes a new goal and a new mark of success that he can strive after. Because Newman is more interested in the pursuit than enjoying what he has achieved, he becomes obsessed with winning Claire. I'm enjoying this read more as we get into it. It does seem quite funny how incensed he is. Incensed? Obsessed? What's the word I want? Fixated. Because does he know Claire? Really? At all? Like, it doesn't really seem like he does. And he's so adamant that this is the girl that he has to have. It does seem a little bit projected. Simply Productive said, so, more little family politics. This makes me think of my own family quite a lot because my family is so conservative. Men have had to jump through quite the hoops. One man sat and asked my parents for permission to date me. My mother then proceeded to warn him that I was immature and would break his heart. It went the other way around, just saying. In the same way, Newman is jumping through tons of hoops with his family. I'm wondering, these obligations are that he is signing himself into. What exactly do they expect of him? It's really funny. About your young man who had to ask your parents' permission to date you. And your mum saying, no, she's immature, she'll break your heart. That's so funny. That's such a mum thing to do. My mum wouldn't do that, but it's a mum thing to do. But I imagine that. Imagine seeing your kid and some innocent young man wants to date your child. But you know, oh, son, look, mate, I know my kid and she's an idiot. She's an immature little brat. She's going to break your heart, you poor boy. Run away. Oh, dear. Imagine. Is that good? I don't know. It's funny, though. Also, I didn't mean to, in a roundabout way, say that you were an idiot as an immature teen. I was more trying to adopt a character there. Waraka Akbar. Hey, I haven't seen that name for a while. Waraka. Where are you been, mate? I don't know. I feel like Newman was just inducted. Oh, inducted. Yep, that's the word. I feel like Newman was just inducted into a secret society. I'm as baffled as he by all the nudging and winking. We are supposed to feel bewildered by this family's behavior, right? Or am I missing something? Rod Favre says, I was confused by this as well, but then I remembered they say they are a strange family about 6 times. I'm interested in finding out what strange means to them, though. One thing that struck me was the mother was so clear that she dislikes him. But then he's like, I've got money. And she's like, okay, I don't like you still, but yeah, ticks all my boxes. And she's just like, yeah, that'll work. I give you permission to marry my girl. I still think you're a total dipshit. I hate you. But money is money, so, you know, welcome. I found that amusing. That wasn't verbatim of how the dialogue went. I might have spruced it up a little bit, but it was something like that. what are we doing here? Reading another chapter. That's a yawn. See, that yawn, I don't even know if that yawn was a, oh, I'm still waking up at the beginning of my day type yawn, or a, oh, it's 4 a.m, I'm tired for staying up so late type yawn. I don't know. I do have a feeling, though, that come, let's say, 8 a.m., I'm still going to be awake. Let's just hope I do something productive between now and then. Speaking of productive things, let's read chapter 13. 13, that's the devil's number. I'm in a weird mood. It might be the 11 days of social isolation. All right, here we go. Newman kept his promise, or his menace, of going often to the Rue de l'Université, and during the next 6 weeks he saw Madame de Sintry more times than he could have numbered. He flattered himself that he was not in love, but his biographer may be supposed to know better. He claimed at least none of the exemptions and emoluments of a romantic passion. Love, he believed, made a fool of a man, and his present emotion of not folly but wisdom, wisdom sound, serene, well-directed. What he felt was an intense, all-consuming tenderness which had for its object an extraordinarily graceful and delicate, and at the same time impressive, woman who lived in a large grey house on the left bank of the Seine. This tenderness turned very often into a positive heartache, a sign in which certainly Newman ought to have read the appellation which science has conferred upon his sentiment. When the heart has a heavy weight upon it, it hardly matters whether the weight be of gold or of lead. When, at any rate, happiness passes into that place in which it becomes identical with pain, a man may admit that the reign of wisdom is temporarily suspended. Newman wished Madame de Sintry so well that nothing he could think of doing for her in the future rose to the high standard which his present mood had set itself. She seemed to him so felicitous, a product of nature and circumstance, that his invention, musing on future combinations, was constantly catching its breath with the fear of stumbling into some brutal comprehension or mutilation of her beautiful personal harmony. This is what I mean by Newman's tenderness. Madame de Sintry pleased him so, exactly as she was, that his desire to interpose between her and the troubles of life and the quality of a young mother's eagerness to protect the sleep of her firstborn child. Newman was simply charmed, and he handled his charm as if it were a music box which would stop if one shook it. There can be no better proof of the hankering epicure that is hidden in every man's temperament, waiting for a signal from some divine confederate that he may safely peep out. Newman at last was enjoying purely, freely, deeply. Certain of Madame de Sintry's personal qualities, the luminous sweetness of her eyes, the delicate mobility of her face, the deep liquidity of her voice, filled all his consciousness. A rose-crowned Greek of old, gazing at a marble goddess, with his whole bright intellect resting satisfied in the act, could not have been a more complete embodiment of the wisdom that loses itself in the enjoyment of quiet harmonies. He made no violent love to her, no sentimental speeches. He never trespassed on what she had made him understand was for the present forbidden ground, but he had nevertheless a comfortable sense that she knew better from day to day how much he admired her. Though in general he was no great talker, he talked much, and he succeeded perfectly in making her say many things. He was not afraid of boring her, either by his disclosure or by his silence, and whether or no he did occasionally bore her, it is probable that, on the whole, she liked him only the better for his absence of embarrassment, of the embarrassed scruples. Her visitors, coming in often while Newman sat there, found a tall, lean, silent man in a half-lounging attitude, who laughed out sometimes when no one had meant to be droll, and remained grave in the presence of calculated witticisms, for appreciation of which he had apparently not the proper culture. It must be confessed that the number of subjects upon which Newman had no ideas was extremely large, and it must be added that as regards those subjects upon which he was without ideas, he was also perfectly without words. He had little of the small change of conversation, and his stock of ready-made formulas and phrases was scantiest. On the other hand, he had plenty of attention to bestow, and his estimate of the importance of a topic did not depend upon the number of clever things he could say about it. He himself was almost never bored, and there was no man with whom it would have been a greater mistake to suppose that silence meant displeasure. What it was that entertained him during some of his speechless sessions, I must, however, confess myself unable to determine. We know, in a general way, that a great many things which were old stories to a great many people had the charm of novelty to him. But a complete list of his new impressions would probably contain a number of surprises for us. He told Madame de Cintry 100 long stories. He explained to her, in talking of the United States, the working of various local institutions and mercantile customs. Judging by the sequel, she was interested, but one would not have been sure of it beforehand. As regards her own talk, Newman was very sure himself that she herself enjoyed it. This was a sort of amendment to the portrait that Mrs. Tristram had drawn of her. He discovered that she had naturally an abundance of gaiety. He had been right at first in saying she was shy. Her shyness, in a woman whose circumstances and tranquil beauty afforded every facility for well-mannered hardihood, was only a charm the more. For Newman it had lasted some time, and even when it went it left something behind it which for a while performed the same office. Was this the tearful secret of which Mrs. Tristram had had a glimpse, or of which, as of her friend's reserve, her high breeding and her profundity, she had given a sketch of which the outlines were perhaps rather too heavy? Newman supposed so, but he found himself wondering less every day what Madame de Cintry's secrets might be, and more convinced that secrets were, in themselves, hateful things to her. She was a woman for the light, not for the shade, and her natural line was not picturesque reserve and mysterious melancholy, but frank, joyous, brilliant action, with just so much meditation as was necessary, and not a grain more. To this, apparently, he had succeeded in bringing her back. He felt himself that he was an antidote to oppressive secrets. What he offered her was, in fact, above all things, a vast, sunny immunity from the need of having any. He often passed his evenings, when Madame de Cintry had so appointed it, at the chilly fireside of Madame de Bellegarde, contenting himself with looking across the room through narrowed eyelids at his mistress, who always made a point before her family of talking to someone else. Madame de Bellegarde sat by the fire, conversing neatly and coldly with whomever approached her, and, glancing around the room with her slowly restless eye, the effect of which, when it lighted upon him, was to Newman's sense identical with that of a sudden spurt of damp air. When he shook hands with her, he always asked her with a laugh whether she could stand him another evening, and she replied without a laugh that, thank God, she had always been able to do her duty. Newman, talking once of the Marquise to Mrs. Tristram, said that after all it was very easy to get on with her. It always was easy to get on with out-and-out rascals. "And is it by that elegant term," said Mrs. Tristram, "that you designate the Marquise de Bellegarde?" "Well," said Newman, "she is wicked. She is an old sinner." "What is her crime?" asked Mrs. Tristram. "I shouldn't wonder if she had murdered someone, all from a sense of duty, of course." "How can you be so dreadful?" sighed Mrs. Tristram. "I am not dreadful. I am speaking of her favourably." "Pray, what you say when you want to be severe?" "I shall keep my severity for someone else, for the Marquise. There's a man I can't swallow, mix the drinks as I will." "And what has he done?" "I can't quite make it out. It is something dreadfully bad, something mean and underhand and not redeemed by audacity, and his mother's misdemeanours may have been, as his mother's misdemeanours may have been. If he has never committed murder, he has at least turned his back and looked the other way while someone else has committed it. In spite of this invidious hypothesis, which must be taken for nothing more than an example of the capricious play of American humour, Newman did his best to maintain an easy and friendly style of communication with Monsieur de Bellegarde. So long as he was in personal contact with people he disliked extremely to have anything to forgive them, and he was capable of a good deal of unsuspected imaginative effort for the sake of his own personal comfort, to assume for the time that they were good fellows. He did his best to treat the Marquis as one. He believed honestly, moreover, that he could not, in reason, be such a confounded fool as he seemed. Newman's familiarity was never importunate. His sense of human equality was not an aggressive taste or an aesthetic theory, but something as natural and organic as a physical appetite which had never been put on a scanty allowance and consequently was innocent and ungrateful eagerness. His tranquil unsuspectingness of the relativity of his own place in the social scale was probably irritating to Monsieur de Bellegarde, who saw himself reflected in the mind of his potential brother-in-law in a crude and colourless form, unpleasantly dissimilar to the impressive image projected upon his own intellectual mirror. He never forgot himself for an instant and replied to what he must have considered Newman's advances with mechanical politeness. Newman, who was constantly forgetting himself and indulging in an unlimited amount of irresponsible inquiry and conjecture, now and then found himself confronted by the conscious, ironical smile of his host. What the deuce Monsieur de Bellegarde was smiling at, he was at a loss to divine. Monsieur de Bellegarde's smile may be supposed to have been for himself a compromise between a great many emotions. So long as he smiled, he was polite, and it was proper he should be polite. A smile, moreover, committed him to nothing more than politeness and left the degree of politeness agreeably vague. A smile, too, was neither dissent, which was too serious, nor agreement, which might have brought on terrible complications. And then a smile covered his own personal dignity, which in this critical situation he was resolved to keep immaculate. It was quite enough that the glory of his house should pass into eclipse. Between him and Newman, his whole manner seemed to declare that there could be no interchange of opinion. He was holding his breath so as not to inhale the odour of democracy. Newman was far from being versed in European politics, but he liked to have a general idea of what was going on about him, and he accordingly asked Monsieur de Bellegarde several times what he thought of public affairs. Monsieur de Bellegarde answered with suave concision that he thought as ill of them as possible, that they were going from bad to worse, and that the age was rotten to its core. This gave Newman, for the moment, an almost kindly feeling for the Marquis. He pitied a man for whom the world was so cheerless a place, and the next time he saw Monsieur de Bellegarde, he attempted to call his attention to some of the brilliant features of the time. The Marquis presently replied that he had but a single political conviction, which was enough for him. He believed in the divine right of Henry Bourbon, fifth of his name, to the throne of France. Newman stared, and after this he ceased to talk politics with Monsieur de Bellegarde. He was not horrified nor scandalized. He was not even amused. He felt, as he should have felt if he had discovered in Monsieur de Bellegarde a taste for certain oddities of diet, an appetite, for instance, for fish bones or nutshells. Under these circumstances, of course, he would never have broached dietary questions with him. One afternoon, on his calling on Madame de Cintry, Newman was requested by the servant to wait a few moments, as his hostess was not at liberty. He walked about the room a while, taking up her books, smelling her flowers, and looking at her prints and photographs, which he thought prodigiously pretty, and at last he heard the opening of a door to which his back was turned. On the threshold stood an old woman, whom he remembered to have met several times in entering and leaving the house. She was tall and straight and dressed in black, and she wore a cap which, if Newman had been initiated into such mysteries, would have been a sufficient assurance that she was not a Frenchwoman, a cap of pure British composition. She had a pale, decent, depressed-looking face, and a clear, dull English eye. She looked at Newman a moment, both intently and timidly, and then she dropped a short, straight English curtsy. "Madame de Cintry begs you will kindly wait," she said. "She has just come in. She will soon have finished dressing." Oh, I will wait as long as she wants, said Newman. Pray tell her not to hurry. Thank you, sir, said the woman softly, and then, instead of retiring with her message, she advanced into the room. She looked about her for a moment and presently went to a table and began to arrange certain books and knick-knacks. Newman was struck with the high respectability of her appearance. He was afraid to address her as a servant. She busied herself for some moments with putting the table in order and pulling the curtains straight while Newman walked slowly to and fro. He perceived at last from her reflection in the mirror as he was passing that her hands were idle and that she was looking at him intently. She evidently wished to say something, and Newman, perceiving it, helped her to begin. "You are English?" he asked. "Yes, sir, please," she answered quickly and softly. "I was born in Wiltshire." "And what do you think of Paris?" "Oh, I don't think of Paris, sir," she said in the same tone. "It is so long since I have been here." "Ah, you've been here very long?" "It is more than 40 years, sir. I came over with Lady Emmeline."
"You mean with old Madame de Bellegarde?"
"Yes, sir, I came with her when she was married. I was my lady's own woman."
"And you have been with her ever since?"
"I've been in the house ever since. My lady has taken a younger person. You say I am very old. I do nothing regular now, but I keep about." "You look very strong and well," said Newman, observing the erectness of her figure and a certain venerable rosiness in her cheek. "Thank God I am not ill, sir. I hope I know my duty too well to go panting and coughing about the house, but I'm an old woman, sir, and it is an old woman that I venture to speak to you. As an old woman, I venture to speak to you."
"Oh, speak out," said Newman, curiously. "You needn't be afraid of me."
"Yes, sir, I think you are kind. I have seen you before."
"On the stairs, you mean?"
"Yes, sir. When you have been coming to see the Countess, I have taken the liberty of noticing that you come often."
"Oh, yes, I come very often," said Newman, laughing. "You need not have been wide awake to notice that."
"Excuse me. I have noticed it with pleasure, sir," said the ancient tirewoman, gravely, and she stood looking at Newman with a strange expression on her face. The old instinct of deference and humility was there, the habit of decent self-effacement and knowledge of her own place. But there, mingled with it, a certain mild audacity, a born of the occasion and of a sense probably of Newman's unprecedented approachableness. And beyond this, a vague indifference to the old proprieties, as if my lady's own woman had at last begun to reflect that since my lady had taken another person, she had a slight reversionary property in herself. "You take a great interest in my family."
"In the family," said Newman.
"A deep interest, sir, especially in the Countess." "I'm glad of that," said Newman. And in a moment he added, smiling, "So do I."
"So I suppose, sir, we can't help noticing these things and having our ideas, can we, sir?"
"You mean as a servant," said Newman.
"Ah, there it is, sir. I am afraid that when I let my thoughts meddle with such matters, I am no longer a servant, but I am so devoted to the Countess. If she were my own child, I could not love her more. That is how I come to be so bold, sir. They say you want to marry her."
Newman eyed his interlocutress and satisfied himself that she was not a gossip, but a zealot. She looked anxious, appealing, discreet.
"It's quite true," he said. "I want to marry Madame de Cintré."
"And to take her away to America?"
"I'll take her wherever she wants to go."
"The farther away, the better, sir," exclaimed the old woman with a sudden intensity, but she checked herself and, taking up a paperweight in mosaic, began to polish it with her black apron. "I don't mean anything against the family or the house, sir, but I think a great change would do the poor Countess good. It's very sad here."
"Yes, it's not very lively," said Newman, "but Madame de Cintré is gay herself."
"She is everything that is good. You will not be vexed to hear that she has been gayer for a couple of months past than she has been in many a day before." Newman was delighted to gather this testimony to the prosperity of his suit, but he repressed all violent marks of elation. "Has Madame de Cintré been in bad spirits before this?" he asked.
"Poor lady, she had good reason.
Monsieur de Cintré was no husband for a sweet young lady like that. And then, as I say, it has been a sad house. It is better, in my humble opinion, that she were out of it. So if you will excuse me for saying so, I hope she will marry you."
"I hope she will," said Newman.
"But you must not lose courage, sir, if she doesn't make up her mind at once. That is what I wanted to beg of you, sir. Don't give it up, sir. You will take it ill if I say it is a great risk for any lady at any time, all the more when she has got rid of one bad bargain. But if she can marry a good, kind, respectable gentleman, I think she had better make up her mind to it. They speak very well of you, sir, in the house, and, if you will allow me to say so, I like your face.
You have a very different appearance from the late account. He wasn't 5 feet high, and they say your fortune is beyond everything. There is no harm in that. So I beseech you to be patient, sir, and bide your time. If I don't say this to you, sir, perhaps no one will. Of course, it is not for me to make any promises. I can understand for nothing. But I think your chance is not so bad, sir. I am nothing but a weary old woman in my quiet corner, but one woman understands another, and I think I make out the Countess. I received her in my arms when she came into the world, and her first wedding day was the saddest of my life. She owes it to me to show me another and a brighter one. If you will hold firm, sir, and you look as if you would, I think we may see it. I am much obliged to you for your encouragement, said Newman, heartily. One can't have too much. I mean to hold firm, and if Madame de Cintry marries me, you must come and live with her. The old woman looked at him strangely with her soft, lifeless eyes. It may seem a heartless thing to say, sir, when one has been 40 years in a house, but I may tell you that I should like to leave this place. Why, it's just the time to say it, said Newman fervently. After 40 years, one wants a change. You're very kind, sir, and his faithful servant dropped another curtsy and seemed disposed to retire, but she lingered a moment and gave a timid, joyless smile. Newman was disappointed, and his fingers stole half shyly, half irritably into his waistcoat pocket. His informant noticed the movement. Thank God I am not a Frenchwoman, she said. If I were, I would tell you with a brazen simper, old as I am, that if you please, monsieur, my information is worth something. Let me tell you so in my own decent English way. It is worth something. How much, please? Said Newman. Simply this. I promise not to hint to the Countess that I have said these things. If that is all, you have it, said Newman. That is all, sir. Thank you, sir. Good day, sir. And having once more slid down telescope-wise into her scanty petticoats, the old woman departed. At the same moment, Madame de Cintry came in by an opposite door. She noticed the movement of the other portiere and asked Newman who had been entertaining him. The British female, said Newman, an old lady in a black dress and a cap, who curtsies up and down and expresses herself ever so well. An old lady who curtsies and expresses herself? Ah, you mean poor Mrs. Bread. I happen to know that you've made a conquest of her. Mrs. Cake, she ought to be called, said Newman. She is very sweet. She is a delicious old woman. Madame de Cintry looked at him a moment. What can she have said to you? She is an excellent creature, but we think her rather dismal. I suppose, Newman answered presently, that I like her because she has lived near you so long, since your birth, she told me. Yes, said Madame de Cintry simply. She is a very faithful. I can trust her. Newman had never made any reflections to this lady upon her mother, and her brother Urbane had given no hint of the impression they made upon him. But, as if she had guessed his thoughts, she seemed careful to avoid all occasion for making him speak of them. She never alluded to her mother's domestic decrees. She never quoted the opinions of the Marquise. They had talked, however, of Valentin, and she had made no secret of her extreme affection for her younger brother. Newman listened sometimes with a certain harmless jealousy. He would have liked to divert some of her tender allusions to his own credit. Once Madame de Cintry told him with a little air of triumph about something that Valentin had done, which she thought very much to his honour. It was a service he had rendered to an old friend of the family, something more serious than Valentin was usually supposed capable of being. Newman said he was glad to hear of it, and then began to talk of something which lay upon his own heart. Madame de Cintry listened, but after a while she said, I don't like the way you speak of my brother Valentin. Hereupon Newman, surprised, said that he had never spoken of him but kindly. It's too kindly, said Madame de Cintry. It's a kindness that costs nothing. It is the kindness you show to a child. It is as if you didn't respect him. Respect him? Why, I think I do. You think? If you're not sure, it is no respect. Do you respect him? Said Newman. If you do, I do. If one loves a person, that is a question one is not bound to answer, said Madame de Cintry. You should not have asked it of me, then. I am very fond of your brother. He amuses you, but you would not like to resemble him. I shouldn't like to resemble anyone if it is hard enough work resembling oneself. What do you mean, asked Madame de Cintry, by resembling oneself? Why, doing what is expected of one, doing one's duty. But that is only when one is very good. Well, a great many people are good, said Newman. Valentin is quite good enough for me. Madame de Cintry was silent for a short time. He is not good enough for me, she said at last. I wish he would do something. What can he do? Asked Newman. Nothing. Yet he is very clever. It is a proof of cleverness, said Newman, to be happy without doing anything. I don't think Valentin is happy in reality. He is clever, generous, brave, but what is there to show for it? To me, there is something sad in his life, and sometimes I have a sort of foreboding about him. I don't know why, but I fancy he will have some great trouble, perhaps an unhappy end. Oh, leave him to me, said Newman jovially. I'll watch over him and keep harm away. One evening, in Madame de Bellegarde's salon, the conversation had flagged most sensibly. The Marquise walked up and down in silence, like a sentinel at the door of some smooth-fronted citadel of proprieties. His mother sat staring at the fire. Young Madame de Bellegarde worked at an enormous band of tapestry. Usually there were three or four visitors, but on this occasion a violent storm sufficiently accounted for the absence of even the most devoted habitues. In the long silences, the howling of the wind and the beating of the rain were distinctly audible. Newman sat perfectly still, watching the clock, determined to stay till the stroke of 11, but not a moment longer. Madame de Cintry had turned her back to the circle, and had been standing for some time with the uplifted curtain of a window, with her forehead against the pane, gazing out into the deluged darkness. Suddenly she turned round toward her sister-in-law. "For heaven's sake," she said, with peculiar eagerness, "go to the piano and play something." Madame de Bellegarde held up her tapestry and pointed to a little white flower. "Don't ask me to leave this. I am in the midst of a masterpiece. My flower is going to smell very sweet. I am putting in the smell with this gold-coloured silk. I am holding my breath. I can't leave off. Play something yourself." "It is absurd for me to play when you are present," said Madame de Cintry. But the next moment she went to the piano and began to strike the keys with vehemence. She played for some time, rapidly and brilliantly. When she stopped, Newman went to the piano and asked her to begin again. She shook her head, and on his insisting, she said, "I've not been playing for you, I've been playing for myself." She went back to the window again and looked out, and shortly afterwards left the room. When Newman took leave, Urbain de Bellegarde accompanied him, as he always did, just three steps down the staircase. At the bottom stood a servant with his overcoat. He had just put it on when he saw Madame de Cintry coming towards him across the vestibule. "Shall you be at home on Friday?" Newman asked. She looked at him a moment before answering his question. "You don't like my mother and my brother," she said. He hesitated a moment, and then he said softly, "No." She laid her hand on the balustrade and prepared to ascend the stairs, fixing her eyes upon the first step. "Yes, I shall be at home on Friday," she passed up the wide, dusky staircase. On the Friday, as soon as he came in, she asked him to please tell her why he disliked her family. "Dislike your family?" he exclaimed. "That's a horrid sound. I didn't say so, did I? I didn't mean it, if I did." "I wish you would tell me what you think of them," said Madame de Cintry. "I don't think of any of them but you." "That is because you dislike them. Speak the truth. You can't offend me." "Well, I don't exactly love your brother," said Newman. "I remember now, but what is the use of me saying so? I had forgotten it." "You are too good-natured," said Madame de Cintry gravely. Then, as if to avoid the appearance of inviting him to speak ill of the Marquise, she turned away, motioning him to sit down. But he remained standing before her and said presently, "What is of much more importance is that they don't like me." "No, they don't," she said. "And don't you think they are wrong?" Newman asked. "I don't believe I am a man to dislike." "I suppose that a man who may be liked may also be disliked, and my brother, my mother," she added, "have not made you angry?"
"Yes, sometimes."
"You have never shown it."
"So much the better."
"Yes, so much the better. They think they have treated you very well."
"I have no doubt they might have handled me much more roughly," said Newman. "I am much obliged to them, honestly."
"You are generous," said Madame de Cintry. "It's a disagreeable position."
"For them, you mean, not for me."
"For me," said Madame de Cintry.
"Not when their sins are forgiven," said Newman. "They don't think I am as good as they are. I do. But we shan't quarrel about it."
"I can't even agree with you without saying something that has a disagreeable sound. The presumption was against you, that you probably don't understand."
Newman sat down and looked at her for some time. "I don't think I really understand it, but when you say it, I believe it."
"That's a poor reason," said Madame de Cintry, smiling.
"No, it's a very good one. You have a high spirit, a high standard, but with you it's all natural and unaffected. You don't seem to have stuck your head into a vice, as if you were sitting for the photograph of propriety. You think of me as a fellow who has had no idea in life but to make money and deprive sharp bargains. That's a fair description of me, but it is not the whole story. A man ought to care for something else, though I don't know exactly what. I cared for money-making, but I never particularly cared for the money. There was nothing else to do, and it was impossible to be idle. I've been very easy to others and to myself. I've done most of the things that people ask me. I don't mean rascals. As regards your mother and your brother, Newman added, there's only one point upon which I feel that I might quarrel with them. I don't ask them to sing my praises to you, but I ask them to let you alone. If I thought they talked ill of me to you, I should come down upon them. They have let me alone, as you say. They have not talked ill of you. In that case, cried Newman, I declare they are only too good for this world. Madame de Cintry appeared to find something startling in his exclamation. She would perhaps have replied, but at this moment the door was thrown open by Urbain de Bellegarde, stepped across the threshold. He appeared surprised at finding Newman, but his surprise was but a momentary shadow across the surface of an unwonted joviality. Newman had never seen the Marquis so exhilarated. His pale, unlighted countenance had a sort of thin transfiguration. He held open the door for someone else to enter, and presently old Madame de Bellegarde appeared, leaning on the arm of a gentleman whom Newman had not seen before. He had already risen, and Madame de Cintry rose, as she always did before her mother. The Marquis, who was greeted Newman almost genially, stood apart, slowly rubbing his hands. His mother came forward with her companion. She gave a majestic little nod at Newman, and then she released the strange gentleman, that he might make his bow to her daughter. "My daughter," she said, "I have brought you an unknown relative, Lord Deepmere. Lord Deepmere is our cousin, but he has done only today what he ought to have done long ago, come to make our acquaintance." Madame de Cintry smiled and offered Lord Deepmere her hand. "It is very extraordinary," said the noble laggard, "but this is the first time that I have ever been in Paris for more than 3 or 4 weeks." "And how long have you been here now?" asked Madame de Cintry. "Oh, for the last 2 months," said Lord Deepmere. These two remarks might have constituted an impertinence, but a glance at Lord Deepmere's face would have satisfied you, as it appeared, apparently satisfied Madame de Cintry, that they constituted only a naivety. When his companions were seated, Newman, who was out of the conversation, occupied himself with observing the newcomer. Observation, however, as regards Lord Deepmere's person, had no great range. He was a small, meagre man of some 33 years of age, with a bald head and a short nose and no front teeth in the upper jaw. He had round, candid blue eyes and several pimples on his chin. He was evidently very shy, and he laughed a great deal, catching his breath with an odd, startling sound, as the most convenient imitation of repose. His physiognomy denoted great simplicity, a certain amount of brutality, and probable failure in the past to profit by rare educational advantages. He remarked that Paris was awfully jolly, but that for real, thorough-paced entertainment, it was nothing to Dublin. He even preferred Dublin to London. Had Madame de Cintry ever been to Dublin, they must all come over there some day, and he would show them some Irish sport. He always went to Ireland for the fishing, and he came to Paris for the new Offenbach things. They always brought them out in Dublin, but he couldn't wait. He had been 9 times to hear La Pomme de Paris. Madame de Cintry, leaning back with her arms folded, looked at Lord Deepmere with a more visibly puzzled face than she usually showed to society. Madame de Bellegarde, on the other hand, wore a fixed smile. The Marquis said that among light operas his favourite was the Gazza Ladra. The Marquis then began a series of inquiries about the Duke and the Cardinal, the old Countess and Lady Barbara, after listening to which and to Lord Deepmere's somewhat irreverent responses for a quarter of an hour, Newman rose to take his leave. The Marquis went with him 3 steps into the hall. "Is he Irish?" asked Newman, nodding in the direction of the visitor. "His mother was the daughter of Lord Finucane," said the Marquis. "He has great Irish estates. Lady Bridget, in the complete absence of male heirs, either directly or collateral, a most extraordinary circumstance, came in for everything. But Lord Deepmere's title in English and his English property is immense. He is a charming young man." Newman answered nothing, but he detained the Marquis as the latter was beginning gracefully to recede. "It's a good time for me to thank you," he said, "for sticking so punctiliously to our bargain, for doing so much to help me with your sister." The Marquis stared. "Really, I've done nothing that I can boast of," he said. "Oh, don't be modest," Newman answered, laughing. "I can't flatter myself that I'm doing so well simply by my own merit, and thank your mother for me, too," and he turned away, leaving Monsieur de Bellegarde looking after him. Alrighty, there we go. That's another chapter. Chaptered. Well done, everybody. That was a long one. That went for more than half an hour. All right. Thank you very much for listening. Have fun in isolation. Don't go mad. Stay sane. And I'll see you tomorrow.